Good morning, everyone. My name is Austin Smith. Welcome to the show Poets Table, where I share with you one of my favorite poets in the hopes that they might become one of your favorite poets. And this morning, I'll be talking about the great American, also you could call her an expat poet, Elizabeth Bishop. Elizabeth Bishop was born in Nova Scotia in 1911. She had a very, very difficult childhood. Her father died when she was just a baby, and her mother was seriously mentally ill and was committed to an institution. So Bishop was actually raised by her maternal grandparents and eventually was brought by her wealthier paternal grandparents to Massachusetts. She was a very precocious poet. She started writing poems at a very young age. She became friends and kind of a mentee of an older female poet named Marianne Moore, who kind of took Bishop under her wing. So Elizabeth Bishop spent some time in New York City. She then traveled extensively in Europe. She would become one of the great writers of travel poetry, I think, in American poetry. Many of her poems, because of her kind of peripatetic lifestyle, take place abroad, in places like Brazil, where she lived for many years, as well as some time that she spent in Europe as well. So she grew up kind of all over the place, and it was actually very coincidental that she landed in the country of Brazil. She was there's an anecdote that she was on a ship. She was extraordinarily allergic to cashew nuts, and she happened to eat a cashew and had a terrible allergic reaction. And it basically forced her to spend some time kind of resting and recovering in Brazil, where she met an architect named Lota de Macedo Soares. And Bishop, being a lesbian poet, spent basically 14 years of her life living with this female architect in Brazil. And they built a house together there. They had a whole life in Brazil together. And tragically, Soares committed suicide in 1967. And Bishop had to leave Brazil. And she spent kind of the latter part of her life living in New York and San Francisco and in Massachusetts, kind of teaching wherever she could find teaching work. She was not a very prolific poet in that she didn't publish a lot of collections. She wrote very slowly, and her very good friend, the poet Robert Lowell, recalled seeing unfinished poems on the refrigerator at Bishop's apartment, poems that were very close to being finished, but Bishop was waiting for the right word, and so there would be like a blank line or a blank where there should have been a word, and she was just waiting for the right word to come to her, and she would sometimes wait for years before she declared a poem finished. So she worked very slowly, and though she ultimately did write a lot of poems in her lifetime, only a handful of collections were published. But she became kind of a poet's poet. In other words, other poets adored her work and kind of waited with bated breath for her collections to come out. And she wrote, as I said, a lot about travel, a lot about displacement, a lot about loss. And I'm going to share with you today probably two poems by Bishop, the first being her most famous poem, called One Art, and the second being another quite famous, but maybe not quite as famous poem, At the Fish Houses. And I think that these two poems will give you a sense for her style. She had a, you might say, a kind of conversational tone in her work, which I really appreciate. It's easy to dismiss her as being almost a prosaic poet. She's very accessible. I think this is one of the reasons that she has become so popular since her death. She is a poet who can kind of be deceptively simple on the page, but I feel that her work begs rereading and revisiting. And She was a very complicated figure. She also wrote fiction. She's a very prolific letter writer. There are some amazing collections of letters, particularly a collection of letters that she exchanged with the poet I mentioned before, Robert Lowell. They had a very, very close friendship. And there was something about her that she's become almost like a cult figure in not only in American poetry, but I think in literature generally. I've read a novel about her. There is a movie that was made about her life. I can't really recommend it. It's not terribly interesting, but there's something about her biography that has really captured attention. And I think that sometimes we can lose sight of her work in the midst of our fascination with her life. So I'm going to share now, as I said before, two poems, the first being probably her most famous poem called One Art. One Art is in a poetic form we call the villanelle. And you'll hear when I read the poem that it has a particular rhyme scheme. If you want to follow along, you can find One Art very easily online. Again, talking about the poet today, Elizabeth Bishop, and the poem One Art, you can find on poets.org or any other website should bring you to this very famous poem. I'll read it now and talk a little bit about how it works. One Art. The art of losing isn't hard to master. So many things seem filled with the intent to be lost that their loss is no disaster. Lose something every day, except the fluster of lost door keys, the hour badly spent. The art of losing isn't hard to master. Then practice losing farther, losing faster. Places and names and where it was you meant to travel. None of these will bring disaster. I lost my mother's watch, and look, my last or next to last of three loved houses went. The art of losing isn't hard to master. I lost two cities, lovely ones, and vaster, some realms I owned, two rivers, a continent. I miss them, but it wasn't a disaster. Even losing you, the joking voice, a gesture I love, I shan't have lied. It's evident the art of losing's not too hard to master, though it may look like, write it, like disaster. It's a little hard to hear, unless you're able to follow along on the page. There's a parenthetical moment at the very end in the last line where Bishop says, write it to herself, really, as if to say that loss might look like disaster, but is not. Indeed, disaster is difficult to admit. And as you've heard, I think when you hear me read the poem, there's a great amount of rhyme and repetition in the poem. This is partly the result of the fact that the poem is a villanelle. And this villanelle was not, it was not originally a villanelle. When Bishop first started drafting the poem, you can actually find online early drafts of the poem in which she is basically just writing prose and just trying to get the ideas down. Slowly but surely, she arrives at the villanelle form, which is, as you could hear, I believe, sort of an obsessive form that repeats itself often. And in a poem that I think is making an argument, where the poet is making an argument with almost themselves about the nature of loss, it's appropriate that the poem is so repetitive. There is one, of course, line that is repeated over and over, and that is, the art of losing isn't hard to master. It's the first line of the poem, and it repeats in most of the stanzas. And then we have the predominant rhyme kind of tropes in the poem, or the rhyme, the musicality of the poem is kind of oriented around the rhyme on master, disaster, fluster, faster, vaster, gesture. And then also another rhyme scheme is meant, spent, went, continent, evident. So these rhyme schemes sort of create an obsessive quality to the poem. And there is a sense that the poet is having to kind of talk themselves into or out of something. there's also a feeling that the poem is concerned at first with very small losses, and then the losses become, as the poet puts it, vaster as the poem goes on. So I'll read the poem again, and then I can talk a little bit about that progression from smaller losses to larger ones. Again, I'm reading One Art by Elizabeth Bishop. The art of losing isn't hard to master. So many things seem filled with the intent to be lost that their loss is no disaster. Lose something every day, except the fluster of lost door keys, the hour badly spent. The art of losing isn't hard to master. Then practice losing farther, losing faster, places and names, and where it was you meant to travel. None of these will bring disaster. I lost my mother's watch, and look, my last, or next to last, of three loved houses went. The art of losing isn't hard to master. I lost two cities, lovely ones, and, vaster, some realms I owned, two rivers, a continent. I missed them, but it wasn't a disaster. Even losing you, the joking voice, a gesture I love, I shan't have lied. It's evident the art of losing's not too hard to master, though it may look like, write it, like disaster. So again, the poet is kind of, I feel almost in a kind of conversation or argument with herself about how hard it really is to lose something or someone in life. And the beginning of the poem, I think that the poet is more confident in this belief, right? So we have the poet losing their keys, or an hour that is badly spent, losing places and names, where it was you meant to travel. Those feel a little bit more dire, but the poet insists that none of these will bring disaster. Even losing an heirloom watch, and even losing three loved houses, the poet continues to insist that it's still not difficult to practice the art of losing, or to, maybe we could say, practice the art of acceptance of loss. Then the poet loses two cities and two rivers and an entire continent. And we can imagine that Bishop might be writing about her time in South America in that image. And she admits there that she misses them, but it still isn't a disaster. And then there's this final stanza in which she says, you know, even losing you, which Bishop had several lovers in her life. It could be Loda. It could be one of the women that Bishop was with at the end of her life. She's saying she still won't be lying if she says that it's not a disaster. And then she kind of, the language of the poem becomes a little bit wishy-washy. It's evident the art of losing is not too hard to master. So you feel the poet's confidence slipping a little bit in the argument they're making. And in the final line, again, as I said earlier, there's this very strange moment where the poet actually instructs herself to write something that is apparently difficult to say. Though it may look like, parenthesis, write it, parenthesis, like disaster. And we get the feeling that there's almost like this other personality that is kind of seething up through the poet and kind of challenging the poet and saying, you know, this actually is a disaster. This actually is very dire and very difficult. And so the poet is sort of in this Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde back and forth with herself. And I think that's one of the reasons that people love this poem so much. It feels like a poem that in which the poet is really wrestling with something that they're not fully certain about. And we get to see that enacted on the page in a really visceral way. So this is one of the great poems, I think. You could call it an elegy, which is a poem about loss. And most elegies are written for the loss of a particular person. This poem is elegiac in that it's about many losses that that the poet has suffered in her lifetime. Elizabeth Bishop once said to her friend Robert Lowell that she was the saddest person on earth. And he felt that she actually was very earnest in saying this, that it wasn't just a gratuitous statement. And I think there's a real triumph in the poem like this, that she wrote indeed after so much loss, you know, the losses she suffered in childhood as well as throughout her adult life. And this does feel to me like a very triumphant poem. And it is a celebration ultimately of endurance and survival. So that was one art by Elizabeth Bishop. Now let's look at another poem called At the Fish Houses. At the Fish Houses is just to prepare you a little bit longer, but I'm going to read it at least once. And I'll talk about it after I finish reading. At the Fish Houses by Elizabeth Bishop. Although it is a cold evening, down by one of the fish houses, an old man sits netting. His net, in the gloaming almost invisible, a dark purple brown, and his shuttle worn and polished. The air smells so strong of codfish, it makes one's nose run and one's eyes water. The five fish houses have steeply peaked roofs, and narrow, cleated gangplanks slant up to storerooms in the gables for the wheelbarrows to be pushed up and down. All is silver, the heavy surface of the sea, swelling slowly as if considering spilling over, is opaque, but the silver of the benches, the lobster pots, and masts scattered among the wild, jagged rocks is of an apparent translucence, like the small old buildings with an emerald moss growing on their shoreward walls. The big fish tubs are completely lined with layers of beautiful herring scales, and the wheelbarrows are similarly plastered with creamy, iridescent coats of mail, with small iridescent flies crawling on them. Up on the little slope behind the houses, set in the sparse, bright sprinkle of grass, is an ancient wooden capstan, cracked, and with two long bleached handles, and some melancholy stains like dried blood where the ironwork has rusted. The old man accepts a lucky strike. He was a friend of my grandfather. We talk of the decline in the population and of codfish and herring while he waits for a herring boat to come in. There are sequins on his vest and on his thumb. He has scraped the scales, the principal beauty, from unnumbered fish with that black old knife, the blade of which is almost worn away. Down at the water's edge, at the place where they haul up the boats, up the long ramp descending into the water, thin silver tree trunks are laid horizontally across the gray stones, down and down at intervals of 4 or 5 feet. Cold, dark, deep, and absolutely clear, element bearable to no mortal, to fish and to seals. One seal particularly I have seen here evening after evening. He was curious about me. He was interested in music, like me, a believer in total immersion, so I used to sing him Baptist hymns. I also sang, "A Mighty Fortress is Our God." He stood up in the water and regarded me steadily, moving his head a little. Then he would disappear, then suddenly emerge almost in the same spot, with a sort of shrug as if it were against his better judgment. Cold, dark, deep, and absolutely clear, the clear gray icy water. Back behind us, the dignified tall firs begin. Bluish, associating with their shadows, a million Christmas trees stand, waiting for Christmas. The water seems suspended above the rounded gray and blue-gray stones. I have seen it over and over, the same sea, the same slightly, indifferently swinging above the stones, icily free above the stones and then the world. If you should dip your hand in, your wrist would ache immediately. Your bones would begin to ache and your hand would burn as if the water were a transmutation of fire that feeds on stones and burns with a dark gray flame. If you tasted it, it would first taste bitter, then briny, then surely burn your tongue. It is like what we imagine knowledge to be, dark, salt, clear, moving, utterly free, drawn from the cold, hard mouth of the world, derived from the rocky breasts forever, flowing and drawn. And since our knowledge is historical, flowing and flown. Again, that was At the Fish Houses by Elizabeth Bishop. It's a long poem. I wanted to share the whole thing. Of course, it's too good to cut off anywhere. It's probably a poem worth checking out online so that you can actually read it on the page. So a quick search of At the Fish Houses by Elizabeth Bishop should bring you to the Poetry Foundation website. I think that Bishop uses many qualities of prose and of, you know, extremely detailed descriptive fiction in her poetry. And so in this poem, I think what is most, to me, what stands out most is the incredible vivacity and vividness of the imagery. And particularly in describing this scene along the coast, we can imagine maybe in Nova Scotia or in Maine, where Bishop also spent a lot of time. And one of the things that I think people immediately connect with is her incredible ability to describe what the surface of this world is plated in, you could say, in these fish scales that have basically come off of these fish, the herring scales that plaster with creamy iridescent coats of mail, everything in this world, including the wheelbarrows and the big fish tubs, and even the flies crawling upon everything are iridescent as well. She uses repetition in the poem in a way that I don't think that we would commonly think to do so. I mean, I think that there's pressure on poets sometimes to have a thesaurus at hand and to choose a different word, but her use of iridescent twice in succeeding lines to me is genius. And it's such a good word, and it links the iridescent coats of mail that plaster the wheelbarrows to the iridescent flies crawling upon them and makes them almost of the same quality. So I think it's very appropriate that she uses the same word twice there. There are characters in the poem too, like we would expect in a short story or a novel. There's the old man who was a friend of her grandfather's who accepts a cigarette from her and sort of in exchange talks of the decline of the population of fish. And, you know, she remarks upon how he has this black old knife, the blade of which is almost worn away, from which he has scraped the scales, which she describes as the principal beauty from unnumbered fish. So he's just a great character who she encounters. He's almost like he almost guides her into this world that the poet is sort of outside of. You know, she's outside of it enough to describe it, whereas the old man is a part of it. And then it may have been hard to hear in my first and probably only reading of the poem, but she encounters this seal. And the seal is given these qualities, basically personified, given these very human qualities. She likens herself to the seal by saying that he was interested in music, like me, a believer in total immersion, so kind of a pun on being a Baptist, right? And she sings to him this Baptist hymn called "A Mighty Fortress Is Our God." And she describes him standing up in the water and staring at her and kind of moving his head a little bit as if he's kind of moving to the music. And they have this very strange connection that we sometimes have with creatures, right? Where there's a feeling of being regarded. And so she is basically encountering these characters of this world and having these interactions, you know, sharing a cigarette with this old man, singing to this seal. But the real character of the poem is the ocean, which she describes as cold, dark, deep, and absolutely clear. And she, again, uses repetition. She says the clear, gray, icy water. Later in the poem, she repeats some of this imagery of how clear and dark the water is and how it seems suspended over the stones. There's a quality to the lines that feels oceanic, almost like she's trying to replicate the feeling of the sea or the sound of the sea in the language itself. She writes, "I've seen it over and over, the same sea, the same slightly indifferently swinging above the stones, icily free above the stones and then the world." So there's something kind of, it's kind of like a spell that she's casting over us with all those S's. And she then puts us, kind of brings us into the poem. She posits that were we to dip our hand in this water, it would be so cold that it would feel like burning. She describes the water as a transmutation of fire that feeds on stones and burns with a dark gray flame. Then she posits that if we were to taste it, it would at first taste bitter and then briny and then burn our tongue. So this is the ocean is capable of burning in two ways. It's so cold that it feels like it's burning the hand, and it's so briny that it feels like it's burning the tongue. And then she has this It's quite a long poem, but it's leading up to this, not properly a metaphor or a simile, but a what she sees the sea as a symbol of is that this is what we imagine knowledge to be: dark, salt, clear, moving, utterly free. That our human knowledge is something like the ocean, drawn from the cold, hard mouth of the world, derived from the rocky breasts forever, flowing and drawn. And since our knowledge is historical, flowing and flown. And so there's something that might be, suggested here about where our knowledge comes from is from a kind of fire or something that can cause a certain kind of pain, something bottomless and mysterious as the ocean is, and something that flows and changes with time and through history. And we realize that we've actually been welcomed into this poem in a very subtle way. Again, as I said at the beginning of the show, she is a poet who is sometimes very, you might describe her as being somewhat prosaic, or the narrative quality of her poetry can be very deceptive. And I think that we kind of get a little bit tricked into this poem, where we're seeing the poem at first maybe as just a little sketch about a particular setting. It's very much about the Northeast coast and the life of small towns along the coast, fishermen, seals. She has this great image of the tall, dignified firs that are like a million Christmas trees waiting for Christmas. So she kind of lures us into the poem, I guess, in a way that is very, it gets me every time, basically. I always forget that the whole poem is bringing me towards this revelatory moment in which the poet is having this revelation about what knowledge might be like, and that the whole poem is actually leading up to this knowledge about knowledge, I guess you could say. And I could have shared with you another poem by Bishop, we're not going to have time today, called The Moose, which is, to paraphrase it, is about the poet is on a bus traveling through the Northeast, probably in Maine, and they are going along and they encounter a moose on the road. And it's a sort of a similar thing in that there's a an encounter the poet has, in this case at the fish houses, was about an encounter with the seal and then the sea. But in The Moose, of course, it's an encounter with the moose. But it's a way she has of taking a seemingly ordinary interaction or encounter and basically making it feel like this almost moment of I keep wanting to use the word revelation, so I will use it again, a revelatory moment that the poet has arrived at, but always through the world and through the physical details of our everyday world, which is what makes Bishop such a, again, I think, accessible poet. If you're intimidated by poetry, I think she's a great poet to begin with. I'd say that she is not a difficult poet to read, but maybe a difficult poet at times to understand. So she may be a good poet to start with if you're intimidated by poetry, or you gravitate towards poems that are at least on the surface easier to parse out. I think that she might be a good one to start with.